All right, this time I'd like to introduce our guest speaker. This time last year, I made that long journey coming down South Carr Drive and turning right into Ridgeview. And, you know, have been towed up from the flow up and disgusted and busted. You know, I went through what we all have gone through, sitting in that lobby, and them telling you 30 more minutes and they'll see you. So after about an hour and a half, not being in the right state of mind, you know, I just had enough. I'm sitting there looking at my car in the parking lot saying, shit, I ain't gonna take this. And so I made two phone calls. I called Dr. Golightly and I called my supplier. I said, whoever gets down here first, I'm going with it. And before I hung up the phone with my supplier, Dr. Golightly had practiced the 12th step. And he came to do some service work, and that's the first time I seen him run, and he came running through the door, and they admitted me. And with that, I've been grateful ever since, and just like he did me, I'm sure he's done a lot of other people in here. So with that, I'd like to introduce you, Daniel G., our guest speaker.
Thank you all for that magnificent gift. It warms my heart, and I can't tell you what this week has been. The thought of coming down here and giving my life story, where I was treated, and I think the person I want to thank most is Henry, because it is because of Henry that he invited me. And Henry is celebrating another year. Stand up, Henry. You know, the first time I gave my life story was in Macon, Georgia. I had about 8 months clean time. And I think the old comers, folks with more time, like to mess with the people with little time, because I had about 7 or 8 months. Went into this very little small, intimate room where there were about 7 or 8 people, and we were doing a big book study. And one of the fellows said, well, Paul, would you come down, not next week, but week after next, and give your life story? I said, yes. I mean, I said, this is wonderful, you know, just 8 people. And when I got down there, man, they were running buses all over the place. and I went up to somebody, I said, hey man, what's going on? He said, some big time surgeon from Emory University is supposed to give his life story. They say he sprung out on cocaine. Well, you know, when God, or the fear of God, is present, your knees tremble. Yeah. So I walked into this place, all these people, my heart cracked open. I said, my God, how am I going to get through this? And the person who led me into this, he said, okay, folks, showtime. I got up to the podium and my knees trembled. But then I had a spiritual experience. Who in the hell knows my life more than me? So I started and I began to stagger and stumble, but it came out. And I see why, what a therapeutic process that is. I mean, I was high for several days to be able to do that. Well, we got 45 minutes here. We'll see what we get through that. I want you to know that I was born here in Atlanta, Georgia, a long, long time ago. The sun was in Capricorn. Moon was in Sagittarius. And over the eastern horizon, Scorpio was rising. Now, I felt I had a very, very good birth. My parents were absolutely angels. I didn't recognize that until later. But I took the name of Daniel Paul Golightly Jr. after my father. And people call me Paul because when they would say Daniel, my father would come a running, and they say, and I would come a running, and mama said, well, listen, since your daddy came first, I'll call you Daniel, call you Paul. So, so then that's the way it was. My earlier childhood was just, I have to say, just joyous. I would be lying down there on the floor, and daddy would come home, and he would have a toy, and me and my brother would fight, and he said, every time I had to go someplace, I got to buy two toys. And then, around 5 to 10 now, my life was dominated by my grandfather. Now, my grandfather was one hell of a man. My grandfather was the first man in Atlanta to have the concept of a private movie theater, a neighborhood movie theater. And he got his sons together, and he began to roll these pictures of Charlie Chaplin and so forth and all those old things. And people came running in droves. And excuse me a minute here, let me get this thing. after a while, a white man came down from City Hall and told him, he said, listen, if you're gonna run this thing, you're gonna have to have a license, and you're gonna have to have an electrician, and they're gonna cost you more than half of what you make. So Grandpa said, well, hell with that. I'll just let it drop. And my grandfather was the only black man who could walk down the streets of Atlanta with a white lawyer who called him Mr. Pooh. Now this is in the early 40s. And to get a sense of power of my grandfather, we would stay with my grandfather during the week, and there would be five of us, me and my brother, two cousins, and three cousins. And one day I was walking into a store, and there was it was a candy store. And we were in there trying to buy some candy. And the store man said, hey, y'all get out of here. Y'all just want to see it. Y'all get out of here. And there was a man over in the corner. He said, hey, them's Gray's children. And the man went back like he had the stroke of God. And he said, well, y'all come on in and take anything on. Now, Grandpa was a big disciplinarian. And he used that switch like this, you know. So one day somebody did some pull up some flowers, and Grandpa said, who the hell did this? And nobody would own up. So Grandpa said, I'm gonna whoop everybody. And my brother said, no, he ain't whooping me. And so Grandpa came, and my brother threw a chair in front of him, and he just fell flat. Boom. Everybody, you could hear a pin drop. And then my grandfather got up. He said, well, I'm going to teach you. If you want to fight, I'm going to let you fight. So he went out and got a Willie Willie switch half the size of his. And my little brother looked up at Grandpa like David did Goliath and walked away. Didn't nobody get whooped that day. Now, after that, my brother and Grandpa were very close. They would be talking on the knee, always on his knee. I can remember down in the yard trying to shoot some marbles, and I look up, and there's my brother on grandfather's knee. So it was 1973, and my brother calls me. He said, "Hey, Paul, check on Grandpa." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, they cited this comic, Kyle Check, and it's supposed to be pretty bright, you know, and it's coming this way." I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He said, "Well, you know, one of them days when Grandpa was on my knee, I asked him, I said, 'Grandpa, when you gonna die?' And Grandpa said, 'I ain't gonna die until the great white light passes across the sky.'" Now, Kyle Check was coming from west to east. When it was, had its greatest intensity in the east, we were putting Grandpa on the ground. And around about 10, you know, I think years later, the idea would come up of civil rights. You know, you would have things like black power and black is beautiful and all kind of stuff like that. Well, hell, 10 years earlier, at the age of 10, the biggest thing was Martin Luther King. He said, "I say, Yolanda, I want you to know, in spite of the injustices, that you are somebody." Well, hell, I got that message clear at 10 years old. And I think because it was so clear, I never was scarred with the shackles of segregation and racism. I'll just give a few examples. When I came home from medical school, there was a thing in the paper that said, make $400 a week. I said, "Well, hell, that sounds good to me." But it was down, it was down on Peace Street. And colored folks didn't go to Peace Street. So I went down there and dressed all up in a seersucker suit, had this nice hat. And walked up there and I walked in and hell, I didn't know what it was, but it turned out to be Grow Your Encyclopedia when I got up there. I said, "Hell, this is a money-making thing here." So the man at the front, he said, "We don't hire colored here." I said, "Yes, sir, I appreciate your attitude." I said, "Do you think I could speak to your manager?" "Well, of course you." So the manager was on a little bit higher level. He saw my suit, he took me on in. I said, "Listen, sir, I come from a very prominent colored family. And both of my parents are school teachers. And their whole life has been education. All their friends are school teachers." He said, "I can take these Grow Your books and I can sell them like hotcakes, because you know colored people, they know they behind and they want to get in front." He said, "Look, I'm going to make you the district manager." And he said, "You take all the area." I said, "Yes, sir, that's a good idea, because I don't think your white folks would be able to penetrate this community like I could." Well, so me and a fellow by the name of John Moore, we began to sell books. And my God, they did sell like hotcakes. And my first check was $400. Now you gotta remember, this is way back, little 60s. You know, in the 60s, school teachers were making $300 and some odd a month. I was making $400 a week. Dad said, "Listen, boy, you better stop this stuff. I know you're messing with the mob, you know." And I said, "No, Daddy." I said, "This is the way white folks make money." So I forgot to tell you this, and then I'll get back to that. You know, from white folk standards, you know, we were poor colored people. From colored folk standards, we were rich colored people and aristocratic, you know. All right. Where was I? Okay, so we started these books. So we're selling these books like hell, and you know, Ralph Moore, he was a preacher's son, and he would always sort of criticize people like sitting on the corners and not doing anything. And he said, "Paul, let me tell you, God says He that has, to him shall be given. But he that has not, even that which he has shall be taken away. I said, where you get that, Ram? That's the scriptures, son. And so that was his attitude. But he could talk, anybody to anything, and he would sell like hell. We sold so many books that this man brought me over to his house, introduced me to his daughters, had my sales force over there, had a party for us, and then I recognized, hell, it wasn't about colored or brown or white or black. It was about the color of green that was the biggest situation. And then it gave me some understanding of how racism works. For example, when I was in New York, me and Priscilla were coming back from a Broadway play. And so she is white looking, even though she's black, you know. So she gets out, she hails a cab, yellow cab. And she said, Paul, come on. Well, I run over there to get in the cab, and the driver pulls away. She says, you a racist bastard. I said, hold on, baby, hold on, you know. I said, look at this man, you know. I said, he's got a wife and a family. You know, he sees me, he knows he's got to go to Harlem. It's risky down there in Harlem. He ain't gonna pick nobody up going no place else. I said, hell, I wouldn't do that myself. She said, you are such a damn fool. So now 10 to high school days, we gotta move here a little bit quicker. my mother was a very, she was always interested in education. She was a mathematician. And about that time, the sort of bourgeoisie Negroes were sending their sons and their daughters to these prep schools, you know. Hell, mama got a hold of that. She said, you know, baby, you going too. So I was sent up to a school called Cushing Academy. Now, Cushing Academy was pretty big time. I mean, y'all heard about Bush going to Andover and Exeter. Well, we played them in sports. We weren't as big as they were, but, you know, we played them. And I think the greatest thing I got from Cushing was William Shakespeare, music, and a strong appreciation of what white wealth was all about, because it blew my mind. So after that, I went on to college, and then I began to have problems. I would get A's in physics and D's and F's in English and things like that, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I remember I got 2 D's in organic chemistry, and that's pretty bad if you're trying to get into medical school. So mom said, well, baby, you go on to Creighton University and you can take this during the summer. Well, I took organic chemistry during the summer and I didn't know what it was. I mean, I do have a learning disability, I didn't know it then. I went on to Creighton University and we had this professor, Dr. Takamata. When Dr. Takamata put organic chemistry on the board, it just lit up like a Christmas tree. I said, my gracious, that's what it's all about, you know? So I got an A and a B in organic chemistry then, and then I got an F in comparative anatomy and an F in something like Western something, you know? So, you know, I was so despondent, so I took my grades home. I said, Mama, I ain't in college material. Oh, baby, yes, you are. Them old crazy white folks, they just don't know how to teach my baby. Now, she did that with my brother, too. When my brother was about 6 years old, they said, well, you know, your boy is retarded. And he said, so mama took him over to Emory University. And they did some testing. He said, well, the boy is not retarded. He's got an IQ of 147. It's just since he's so intelligent, he doesn't respond with people who don't speak on his level. Okay, so now, you know, God works in your life all the time, I'm telling you. So, I know I ain't getting into medical school. But mama, she knows her boy. She loves her boy unconditionally, and her boy gonna do anything he wants to do. So mama went ahead and sent applications to Meharry and sent the transcripts. About a month later, I get this letter. Welcome to Meharry Medical College. We want to congratulate you for entering the freshman class. I said, what in the hell is this? Well, when we look back on it, what happened is that when we transferred the grades over to Emory, the D's and the F's didn't transfer. And so they thought, well, hell, this boy here is something else. Now, so I got in medical school, and then I said, I know I got a problem. Them damn books was this thick, you know? So what I did is that I singled out the smartest people in the class, and I made them my friends. And I got the other smartest, and I made all those friends. And when the exam time come, they would get me, they would say, okay, now, Paul, this is what is going to be on the test. I said, how in the hell do you know? He said, because that's what he said in his notes. I said, how do you know that? Well, they'll take a test. They were writing 98. I would write 78. Sometimes 80. Get real lucky, 82. but they helped me because the way I learned was insufficient to, the way I learned, I could not grasp the way it was being taught. But if I was tutored, I did very well. Now, the first 2 years were a struggle. But now when we got on the clinical side, you know, junior here, I'm making rounds, you know. If I can see it, touch and feel it, hell, I can read about it and know it. So I became the diagnostician of the class. And people had a problem. They said, listen, go get Golightly. He can tell you what it is. And so the situation reversed. All right, so I'm in Joseph. I am in Nashville, Tennessee, and I get this drawing a lock or something to go to Columbia Presbyterian University for surgery. You know, which is quite an honor. So I'm supposed to be graduating about, say, June something. But I'm going to New York to find me an appropriate dwelling for myself, since now I am a physician. So I went down to New York, and I looked around, and I saw these garden apartments. Now, you got to remember, in 68, $1,000 is equivalent to about $4,000 now. And so I came in, I saw this beautiful apartment, and he said, who are you? I said, my name is Dr. Golightly, and I want to see this garden apartment here. I think that would be fine for me, you know? So he looked in, I said, yes, sir, I'll take that. He said, well, that's $1,000 a month. I said, you don't understand, I don't want to buy it. I just want to rent it. And he said, well, son, how much money did you think you have? I said, $300 to $400. I was really lying because it wasn't but $200 to $300, you know? He said, well, let me tell you, doctor, with that kind of money, the best thing you can do is go back to Nashville. So we end up getting one of those three-floor walk-ups on 59th and Central Park West, you know. Now, you got to recognize that here's a little color boy, ain't been too many places, Atlanta, Nashville, and now New York City. You know, I mean, that was the most phenomenal thing that I had ever experienced in my life. And on top of all that, after I got into the first year of residency, you know, I was growing as a resident, and it was real. I mean, It was so exciting, and things were so wonderful that I think that the period between 1969 and 1972 were the best years of my life. You know, at no time did the feeling of frustration or doubt enter my mind. And when I rode up and down the subway, even though New York City had those tall buildings and all this wealth, when I rode the subway from 68th Street to 59th, I thought I held New York in the palm of my hand. Because everywhere I went, you know, I was received like a king. So after that, the residency is going great, and then all of a sudden, I get a letter, greetings. You will appear at Fort Washington for basic training to be shipped to Vietnam. And I'm saying, well, wait just a minute, you know? You know, I done jumped a few years ahead, okay? I said, wait just a minute. Now, this is how God works in your life. My cousin worked in Africa as a big diplomat. And he would come to Washington and do things and so forth and so on. But I would only speak to him maybe once every 2 or 3 months. Now, I get these orders from Vietnam. I ain't going, you know. Cali, you know, Lieutenant Cali is being court-martialed for this and that. I ain't going, you know. Oops. So I decide I'm going to go to Canada. Now I know I ain't going to tell my daddy, but I am getting ready to go to Canada. Now, that very night, it was 10 o'clock at night, and my cousin calls. He said, hey, man, what you doing? I said, I'm getting ready to go to Canada. He said, what? You a damn fool. You get your ass down here on the first shuttle plane tomorrow morning, and we'll get this straightened out. So I get on the first shuttle plane, and my cousin, I don't know how he did it. He had me speak with two congressmen. He said, well, these people, they worried about more black people dying than whites. And then he said, now listen, at 10 o'clock, you're going to be in the Surgeon General. This is the Surgeon General of the United States. We're going to be in the Surgeon General's office, and we're going to try to work this thing out. I go in and sit down. Surgeon General comes in. His major comes in. Because this is my cousin, and he ain't going to Vietnam. They said, well, listen, we need doctors in Vietnam, too. He said, well, send them white doctors over to Vietnam. My cousin ain't going, you know. He said, so you get something straightened out here. Anyway, he said, because I will have the Congressional Black Caucus in this office and light it up like the damn White House Christmas tree. And lo and behold, that evening, I'm already 2 weeks AWOL. 2 weeks AWOL. And they cut me orders for Fort Belvoir, which is the most, you know, privileged assignment. You know, usually do a year in Vietnam and then a year at some safe place. But I had 2 years in Vietnam, and the major said, go lightly. You missed basic training. He said, most of the thing basic training does is to teach you how to salute. Do you know how to salute? I said, well, I had some ROTC. He said, well, that's enough. Go on and go on. Now, I need to tell you the first time that I got high, well, I'll go back to this. First time I drank alcohol was my freshman year in college. And that was a pretty nice looking bartender there. And I was going to show her how strong I was, you know. Because she kept asking me, do you want another one? Do you want another one? So I had got to 7 Tom Collins, and I was so drunk as hell. My My friends put me in their car. As they were riding around, I was looking up, I was seeing fire coming down, and I was screaming. Ever since then, I ain't messed with no alcohol. Now, the next time, you know, I'm working like hell as a resident, and I come home, and my wife, she's got three cigarettes there on the table, and she says, "Why don't you smoke one of these cigarettes?" You know, I said, "Well, I knew something was wrong because, she don't want me to smoke, so I smoke. You know, smoke cigarette. You're trying to take smoke drug. Then I lay back, and all of a sudden, we had these brick apartments with the red mortar going through them. This brick began to glow. The mortars in between the brick began to glow. And when we made love that night, the kingdom of heaven came down in the bed. And made it divine, you know. So then I know how I knew what how was like. And then ever since that time, you know, I was always staying back and stuff. You know, I get me a little cannabis, a little sesamilla, man, I'd be the life of the party. And people say, go like, you ain't got no rhythm. You dance like white folks, you know. And then I went out and got this lady came to me, and she said, "Golightly, you dance like a policeman directing traffic." I said, "Well, baby, you better go ahead on and get you a uniform, because I'm having a hell of a time, and you look like you suffering." Oh, boy. Man. Okay, we're gonna have to leave some stuff out. Okay, I really need to tell you how I met my wife, because I was so emotional, I just missed all that, okay. So about sophomore year in medical school, me and the boys, we, run around trying to have parties and things like that. And in these parties, there are women. And that was our main concern, to find us some fine women, all right? So we'll go to one party, ain't nothing happens. Say, "Hey man, look, let's go to another." So I went to this party, and I walked in, and here's this woman sitting by the fireplace. Now I'm looking, you know, I do have mania, I don't know what happened then, but as I looked and that fire began, you know, I saw this light, and there was no doubt in my mind that this woman was an angel. So I went over to her, and the first thing I said, "Hey, will you marry me?" and we began to talk and talk and got closer talking. Well, then I knew it was time for me to make my move. So I said, "Hey, man, I need a crib, you know." So we went to this little apartment with blue sheets and we kept on talking. And this was a very unusual woman, because other women were talking about last night in the Pips, Temptations, Johnny Mathis. She was talking about Dostoevsky, Jean-Paul Sartre, Kierkegaard. And she was just absolutely fascinated. So when I got her in that room, she she said, "And you know, I am so moved by the suffering of Hamlet." I said, "Holy smoke." I said, "Well, honey, you sit right over here." And you know, I set the stage. This was my cushion thing, you know. I set the stage, and I went into my stuff. I said, "Well, I do this best on laying down." And I went into, "Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Oh God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable to me seem all the uses of this world. Fie on it." And you know, I was peeping out my... and I saw these tears running down his face. I said, this here is my woman. This here is my woman, you know? And so we made love the first night. Now, now you know how women are. If you hear a part, because I was telling her, so she's, oh, no. That was much bullshit. It went down the first night. And from that night on, for the next 30 years, I will be totally enmeshed with this woman. Okay, now, we got to get on here. Now, I'm going to have to miss a large part of this thing and just go and get down to the nitty-gritty. I was in my office, and, you know, I wanted to show that I could take care of bank presidents, and I could take care of low-life folks, you know? One day, one of the people of the night came in, and he said, Doc, you sure look tight. I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, I got something for you. So he put this line of cocaine down, you know, with the straw. And so the first time I went, I'm cooking, he said, damn! He said, you know, I'm on with 10. I said, that much? He said, no. He said, no, you got to take it in. And I went down there, I snorted. And boy, it hit, you know, this energy, this wonder. I said, damn, you know, I need some more of this. So I started. And it got so bad that my nose started bleeding. I said, look here, man, I'm an associate professor of surgery. I can't have this stuff going on like this here. I said, you got to do something to help me. He said, well, Doc, I got just the thing for you, but I got to take you over to your house. I said, why? He said, because today we're going to take this to a new level. And so we go to the house, and he's got this little cocaine, this little ball, and he's cooking stuff up. Gets cooked up, drops it down the pipe. He said, okay, Doc, I want you to inhale this. So I inhale, then nothing happened. He said, well, Doc, take it. I inhale, that thing went down through my lungs, up through my brain, and there was no doubt in mind I was seeing Jesus. And from that time on, it was a tragedy. So, finally, my father said, listen, no son of mine is going to be using this stuff and hurt anybody. And so he took me down to Dr. Doug Talbot. As a matter of fact, where I sit now in my office, in 1986, I was sitting there waiting for Doug Talbot. And my father said, well, he said, I can't. He said, I am so glad your mother is dead so she won't see this. I said, look here, man. I said, Freud does this. Halstead does this. This is what surgeons do. I'll go down there and I'll show you what the doctors say. Well, they locked me up. and they locked me up and I got very, very upset. You know, I'm a damn surgeon now. Now, they took me down to Cottage 8. Now, in the back of Cottage A, there's a community room. That's where I had my first group. The group was, how did you get into treatment? You know, people said, well, I do. I said, my daddy, the no good son of a bitch, brought me in here against my will, and I'm pissed off. Now, you got to remember, I peed cocaine for 6 weeks. My urine drug screens were toxic for cocaine for 6 weeks. So I was toxic as hell, you know. So I looked up at the lady, started crying. I said, what's the matter? I mean, the counselor started crying. She said, when I think of a father with that much love for a son that can do that, I am, it just brings tears to my eyes. You know, I'm still, I'm trying to figure, Now, the next group is over in the community room of A, and that's with another counselor where the topic was powerlessness. Powerlessness, right? So, you know, you're supposed to go around and you're supposed to say how you're powerless, you know? So it got to me. He said, well, Dr. Golightly, how about your powerlessness? I said, listen here, man. I'm Dr. Golightly. I'm the chief of the damn trauma unit of Greater Hospital. I deal with life and death every day, and I ain't powerless over a damn thing. So this very caring counselor said, well, Paul, if you're such a big time doctor, why is it that you don't have any money in the bank? And the other day your son cried when somebody came and repossessed one of your cars. Now, you might not be powerless, but wouldn't you agree that your life is unmanageable? Boom! The first hit of reality. Then I had my first AA meeting. Now, the first AA meeting was back there. What's that thing back there at the end? This used to be a big auditorium, and we used to make these little rooms. And that meeting was back there in that little room. And that was about eight of us there. And of course, I'm still angry. I'm still toxic. I ain't got no idea of what's going on. We have the meeting, and the man said, are there any burning issues? He said, what is it? I said, now, let me see this. You are telling me that I can never hit my cocaine pipe again in my whole life, never take a drink of Hennessy again in my whole life, and spend the rest of my life attending meetings with people like people with you all, drunks and junkies? Explain this to me. Well, you know, that was nice. Just get on out of here. And the last person who spoke was a lawyer. And he began to talk about his experiences. He began to defend coke dealers, and pretty soon everybody around him was using coke. He had no one who didn't use coke. The only time he would ask for a recess so he can go back in the thing and get a couple of lines of cocaine. Now, you know, they say in AA, when you hear your story, you're free. Now, I walked down that street there, across over to Cottage A, and about the fourth or fifth step down there, the wind slapped me in the face. It was about a week before Christmas. And when the wind slapped me in the face, it came, could I be an addict? That man sure sounded a whole lot like me. And so I went on home and I read Dr. Bob's story. And I was so moved at the level of suffering that he had gone through to create this wonderful AA thing. And then I read step one, and I cried all night, and I read step two, and I cried all night, and I just couldn't get to three. But I knew that I was an addict. Now, I got up the next morning and started to quoting the scriptures and giving everybody this validation of this great spiritual insight I had come to. Damn if they didn't take me and lock me up in the prison. They said, you got a Bob. I said, hell no, I've had a spiritual experience. I get up there in the crazy house. Come on, we got to move now, boy, because hold on. I get up there in the crazy house, doctor comes in. I said, man, what in the hell is wrong with you? I said, who gave you the authority to put me in here? He said, well, Golightly, you got to act sane. You know, I said, I am saved, you know. He said, well, watch me. He said, I'm gonna leave, walk through this door, and go have dinner, you know. And you try to do that and see what happens. So so I went over there. So I went over there. Tried to open the door, you know, get mad, you know. Cold blue, blue, blue. Now that happened a lot of times. Now, boy, I didn't know it was time. It's 9, man. Good God. Okay, we got to move. All right. Just went through treatment. It's a whole bunch of stuff there, but we just went through treatment and got to my first job. Now, you know, my ego is still pretty big. I got to my first job. I said, well, this is just a stepping stone to my great career in surgery again, you know. So this was an industrial health clinic. In industrial health clinic, every damn thing in there you could treat with Motrin and Robaxin. You know, so I was, I came in there, I saw a patient. You know, I didn't like the patient. I thought he was lying, just wanted to get out of work, you know. And I treated him like that, you know, and wrote stuff down. I had been used to dictating instead of writing stuff down. So I saw 5 or 6 patients like this, and the owner came to me, and he said, Paul, what is this? And I looked at it. It looked like a 5-year-old chicken scratch. And I was shocked. He said, well, don't worry, Paul. We know you're having a hard time, you know. You can come on down here, you know, and try to get your skills back together, you know. But we can't pay you for doing this. And boy, I drove home. When I was driving home that day, the thing came, my God, I'm not even employable. I saw a bridge. I said, well, maybe I can hang on one of these bridges, and maybe my father would send my son to college. And you know how depression is. I came over and I just fell down in the fetal position. And then it came. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. And for the first time in my life, I understood what complete abandon was. The next morning, I went to a job that didn't pay me any money. I sat down, I respected the patients, I listened to their symptoms, I carefully wrote down exactly what they said, I honored their feelings, and then I wrote a prescription for Motrin and Robaxin. But now, not as a big-time surgeon, but a child of God. And that experience was so profound that whenever I pass somebody say, homeless, need food, I stop. Give them a dollar. Sometimes I give them $5, because I know absolutely in the bottom of my soul, were it not for the grace of God, that would be me. All right. So we got to round this thing down. Now, I'm gonna leave you with one a thing here that has always moved me, and that is, you know, 1933 was a very mystical year for Alcoholics Anonymous, because that was when it was put together. Now, when Bill W. was up there trying to get people sober, you know, he would take drunks into his house and he would try to feed them and take care of them, and they'd go out and get drunk. And his wife said, he complained to his wife. He said, listen, these drunks, you know, I try everything I can for them. I do everything I can for them. They just go out and get drunk. She says, yes, but you are not getting drunk. You know? And so from there, he got a hold of Dr. Carl Jung, who is the spiritual father of AA. And he said, Dr. Jung, I need a simple definition so that my alcoholics can understand what their disease is all about. And Jung said, it's a spiritual disease which has at its base a desire for wholeness. A spiritual disease which has at its base a desire for wholeness. Now, when I first heard that, it blew my mind, because it meant every time I picked up that cocaine pipe, I was yearning for wholeness. Every time I got some kind of mind-altering drug. I was yearning for wholeness. And then I began to see is that if I could have the courage to endure the emptiness, to endure the pain, to embrace the pain, and be still, I'll be contacted. And my life moves forward. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the Ridgeville Alumni Community, we'd like to thank Dr. Golightly for that speech, his story tonight. And I'm sure we're going to have to ask him back to do part two, because I know you ran out of time.